Index investing or passive investing has grown more popular with investors. Even Warren Buffett touts the benefits of owning an entire index like the S&P 500 over the long term. An example of an index tracking ETF is BMO's S&P 500 Index ETF. It's the largest ETF in Canada that tracks this well-recognized and popular index. It provides exposure to the returns of the market cap-weighted S&P 500 index at a low cost, the management fee of just 0.08%. This broad market ETF makes for an efficient building block in a portfolio, saving you time and effort while mitigating single stock risk. If you're looking for exposure to the largest and most liquid public companies in the United States, this ETF delivers an easy-to-use solution and instant diversification. Commissions and management fees and expenses all may be associated with investments in exchange-traded funds. Please read the ETF facts or prospectus of the BMO ETFs before investing.
Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that this information discussed today is not intended to be or construed as investment advice. Please consult a professional advisor before putting a loony in any of these financial markets.
The dirty secret is that no one's ever going to get paid back.
People have the shortest memories when it comes to investment.
We just got to get Keith into Bitcoin.
Hey, there's a bubble.
Welcome back to the Loony Hour, episode 128. As always, joined with the three amigos, Keith Dicker, IceCap Asset Management, Rich Diaz, PGM Global. What's going on? Keith, Boomer, you're looking good. I heard you're off the lemon loaves.
Yeah, I know. I've shedded 15 pounds, Rich.
I'm Is that a lot?
Lean, and I'm never mean. I'm always nice. So lean and nice, and I'm feeling fit.
All off lemon loaves. That's the secret.
I know, but the trick is, you know, you always have a your favorite t-shirt, and one of my favorite shirts, it's kind of snug on me for a while, but now I pulled it out and it fits well. So this is
it?
This is one of them. I have a lot of great shirts. This is one of my favorite football teams from down in America. It's a high school team. So the Dillon Panthers, they won the Texas State Championship. I think it was 3 out of 5 years. Pretty good team. And this is one of the players on it, number 33, Tim Briggins.
Bandwagon guy, eh?
Well, no, you got to jump on these teams before they win, Steve, and you stay with them. But
I want to know what Mrs. Ice Cap thinks of the new diet.
Mrs. Ice Cap thinks I'm awesome on so many levels.
Yeah.
No more sunk pizza night.
I think
either.
Sunk cost fallacy. That's sunk cost fallacy for all the kids paying attention at home.
Oh man, like 30 years of love, hey?
That's
what
right.
You pack in. But before, hey guys, this is on Thursday, of course. So this is March Madness starting today. I did my bracket. Did you guys do your bracket?
No.
I have the winner, and my magic eight ball says San Diego State is going to win it all.
Who's that girl who's amazing? From Iowa or something. She's amazing. She's like a transcendent basketball player on the women's side. I'll look it up. She's like the best basketball player since like Pistol Pete from like the 80s or something. We're gonna look it up. Yeah,
Rich,
yeah.
What t-shirt you have there?
Oh, this is like if you're a snooty finance bro from London and you ride bicycles. This is called Condor. They're handmade in Italy.
You're missing That's your Patagonia vest to go with.
No, they're handmade bicycles in Italy. That's how you know you're a big fucking, you're freaking douche if you ride
all the bike lanes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You're right. If you ride a handmade bicycle from Italy, but you buy it in London and you get some kind of tax break. It's called Condor Cycles.
Makes me sick.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm not a big fan of bicycle lanes. I think that that's a conversation for a different day. How are we doing, Steve? What's going on?
wait. Why do you have the t-shirt then? I don't understand.
Because I bought like a $4,000 bike and they threw in the t-shirt.
$4,000 bike. Jesus. We need to keep hiking rates.
Yes, we do need to keep hiking rates. I agree. We're going to get into that.
We got to burst
that bubble, the rich wealth effect bubble.
We had a big week. Obviously, the Fed was out this week. Canada's CPI, the Bank of Japan, the Swiss National Bank, UK Bank. So there's just so much going on. We're going to unpack all of that. But want to sort of touch it up this week to start with the Canadian real estate. We had some data that came out from the Canadian Real Estate Association, basically highlighting the February stats numbers. So you're seeing prices pushing back up again, ever so slightly. I think the overall sentiment, again, still in the housing market is, it's a housing market that's moving just fine. Really nothing exciting to write home about. Inventory is still a real challenge. So anyone that's listening to this podcast, that's like a prospective home buyer or is looking to upsize or whatever, I'm sure you can probably all attest that regardless of the market that you're in, whether you're in Ottawa or in Toronto or in Vancouver, that the inventory that's available on the market today is crap. It sucks. It's not good. It's low. And that's really kept the prices supported. So you can kind of see that. But if we look at it from a overall rate of change perspective, the housing market clearly peaked. House prices nationally are still 14% below the peak. So the peak was, again, in February of 2022. We're still 14% below that, or 22% in real terms. But if you look at like other markets, I mean, most of that decline is actually coming strictly from Ontario. So the decline in BC is less than 8%. Of course, Alberta is still in positive territory. Keith, over in your neck of the woods, it's less than 4%. So it's a housing market that seems to be mostly dominated by Ontario, of course, but that's kind of what's happening in the housing world. Not a whole lot. There's people that kind of tried to front run the Bank of Canada earlier this year. I feel like that's kind of fizzled out a little bit, and we're still running into this inventory picture, which is there's just not a lot of houses for sale.
So will that pick up now as we, you know, move into April and May, supposedly?
I mean, we're kind of in the spring market now. Like, we're like third week of March. I mean, it's supposed to be getting pretty busy, and I'm still finding that the listing count is just really bad.
Can you explain the like cycle for the plebs, e.g., me? Can you explain to us like what the cycle is throughout the year? Like January 1st, like when is the best time to sell, or not the best, but when is the what's hot and what's not?
Yeah.
So Steve, to be clear here, that the $4,000 bicycle t-shirt wearing guy wants to better understand a seasonal cycle.
He spent all his money on the bike.
I don't know anything about the housing market. I'm happy to learn.
March to May is like your spring selling season. That's always like the busiest month, not only in terms of new listings, but in sales volume. So just people, whatever reason, seasonally start to move in the spring. So you get a lot of turnover, a lot of liquidity in the markets. Like if you were a stale listing in the winter, like your time to capitalize on that is back in the spring. Then as you get into like July, August, you get into the summer months, of course, everyone's on vacation, things slow down, picks up again September to basically end of October as like at the fall selling season, which is pretty active. And then again, it will die off in December, January. I mean, honestly, like the best time to buy is probably December. Yeah, you've got fewer listings typically, but you don't have really any competition on the buying side. There's not a whole lot of people that are buying 3 weeks before Christmas, right? So you got a few more motivated people before tax, the end of the year for tax selling reasons, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, that's your typical cycles.
Seems to be a lot of motivated sellers right now.
Oh yeah, about as motivated as one can be in this market.
I bought a boat.
Did you?
Rich doesn't
sell boat? Sailboat or a rowboat? I got another question, even though I ride a fancy bicycle. I'm looking at the data that you mentioned, which is if you go on stats.crea.ca, you can see the sales to new listings ratio peaked sort of in January of 2024 and is starting to roll over. Is that why maybe the house prices are rising again? Because just like not that much inventory.
Well, you don't really get any new listings in January to begin with. I think what I'd say overall is just it's a market that's still trying to find its footing. You know, like there's not really, in my opinion, it's still not like clear direction. You know, I wouldn't call this a bull market. It's definitely not a bear market. It's just kind of muddling along. Yeah, that's the overall take, which is kind of boring, right? I think everyone's basically looking at the Bank of Canada inflation. Like, mortgage rates today are still 5%. You know, like, your three-year fixed rate, which is what everybody's taking, you know, let's call it, let's average it out and call it 5.2 is kind of your average today. So, still pretty high. Now, we're going
to
see if
it's not boring. It's the right answer. That's okay. We're allowed to write to say the right answer. Like,
well, everybody's
people
so
love
used,
us.
Yeah, and everybody's so used to like housing being like this like bull market where prices are going up 20% a year and there's this buzz in the air, and it's just kind of a boring market. It's just not
it's
a lot
okay.
going on.
It's okay. We're allowed to articulate what's going on.
And then 3 years from now, that 3-year rate is at 10. And it's like, holy no. smokes.
Totally disagree. Folks.
Housing is trading like shelter right now, not like a speculative asset, which
That's right.
is strange. Boomer. Canada,
yes,
CPI.
It's strange. I don't know what else to say about it.
Are we doing it? Can I do it?
The CPI? Okay.
Canada CPI, right? Again, if we want to get some direction on the housing market, you know, we need CPI lower. We need the Bank of Canada to cut rates. Cut, baby, cut. And then we'll be back to a new bull market, right?
No, it's not happening. They're not going to cut rates. I know everyone wants to. The Twitter sphere is happening. CBC's after it. Keith, in his infinite wisdom, wants them to cut to 0% interest rates. Isn't that right, Keith?
He's got to cash out his
I think
house
it's the,
here soon.
I think it's the opposite. I think last
I just
week
threw Keith right under the bus. And then backed it up and then went forward and backed it. Listen, so let's do the numbers real quick just for people to understand. As I pick it up here. So we've got, you know, 2.0 for headline, 2.0.
Whoa.
Did I screw it up?
No, let me preface this. So,
oh, sorry. Go ahead.
The expectation from economists, the consensus coming into this CPI print in Canada, was that headline inflation was going to basically reaccelerate from what, 2.9 to 3.1% year over year. So that was the estimate coming into the print. Rich, take it away from there.
No, fair enough. The second week in a row, you've dunked on me, but it's okay.
Stay in your lane.
Stay in my lane. Okay. So you're right. Analyst estimates, which is the sort of the central tendency of, you know, many, many analysts, good and bad, what have you, was for the month-on-month non-seasonally adjusted number to rise from 0.6%. And it rose 0.3%, which is a huge miss, to be honest. And year-on-year, the CPI went from 2.9 to 2.8%. So it fell again. Now, the Bank of Canada, has a target of 2% with a 1% above and a 1% below range. So technically, we are now within the range of the interest rate target, whatever you want.
Cut, baby, cut.
No. So I think people need to understand a couple of things. Number one, to support your view, which is the three preferred measures of core CPI are now, if I can look quickly, is like 3.2, 2.8, and I can't see, it's blurred. My point is, so like those numbers are now well below. And goods, so there's goods and services CPI, goods is now 1.2%, but services is 4.2. Now, Steve, your favorite, shelter, guess what keeps happening to shelter? They keep rising. Do you know why? Because we've let 3.2% of population growth, 95% of which is immigration, and rent inflation keeps rising, and shelter, owner accommodation, and rental accommodation is 6.5, 6.7, and 7.9 respectively. You've made the point repeatedly that mortgage interest costs are starting to roll over, and they're a huge contribution to inflation. I submit to you, sir, that that's irrelevant. I think that that's, you know, that's, it's a big number. I get it. But the reality is that if you're going to have that kind of population growth and you're going to have that kind of shelter growth, you can't cut. So I don't know, Keith, Steve, how did I screw that up?
No, I mean, I'm kind of curious. we had our fearless leader out, Krista Freeland, tweeting. Remember, she kind of bottom ticked the last inflation print was at 2.8, and then it reaccelerated after. So she was out tweeting. I'll quote her here. Our economy continues to outperform expectations with inflation now down to 2.8%. This is good news for Canadians at the grocery store checkout. But rent and mortgage costs are still far too high. That's why we're building more homes faster than any previous government, which, I mean, is not correct.
It's not true at all.
You do have to be fearless to continue coming out with that stuff all the time.
I mean, that's where I get a little bit concerned. I don't know. Maybe we've bottom ticked on inflation again at 2.8 here.
I mean, the interesting thing with this is let's just reset everything. It's we shouldn't expect the Bank of Canada to do something based on our analysis. Instead, you have to say, okay, what are they going to do? What is the culture at the Bank of Canada? Now, are they traditionally dovish or hawkish? And they're hawkish. That's what the culture has been. I think they clearly flew a bit too close to the sun over the last few years, and they have scars now, of course. Absolutely. And I still don't get it in that because this applies for the Americans, everyone else as well, because everyone now has this expectation, because we went down to 0%, now up to 5%, and the expectation is that we got to go back down again to, you know, 3.5%, 3.75% or something like that, because, you know, that's what's absolutely needed. So it's one thing, hey, is the data supporting it? And as of right now, and again, this is what we would do, or I guess so. You know, again, that doesn't really matter because you have to understand what they would do. But you know, why do you need to cut rates dramatically if growth is just doing okay? You know, inflation seems to be working its way out. You know, you have the risk if they cut rates by 75 basis points by the end of the year. And for everyone right now, you know, the market is suggesting this happens as early as June. We get 25 basis points cut. Definitely by the July meeting, but you're looking at June/July, then again in September, and again in December, you know, for the
is growth okay in Canada? I feel like Canada's, you know, we've talked about it, 6 consecutive quarters of negative real GDP per capita. Like I don't know. The economy doesn't really feel that great in Canada.
No, I agree with you. I think it is rolling over pretty hard, but based on current conditions, what they're looking at, my point is that we've gone from volatility in almost everything to the one market that should never have extreme volatility. And that means then it's game over. As soon as your central banks are playing the yo-yo game, it's going to be real tough. I don't know if that's adding any value here with this, but I think though, Steve, you're right. We have to talk about, you know, what's really happening with Canada. I was chatting with a gentleman a couple of days ago, and he had some pretty good anecdotal stories from for some groups that are, you know, well connected across the country. And you know, he shared with me that, you know, there are now lots of tradespeople that are starting to see work is getting slower and slower. So that stuff doesn't show up quite yet, you know, in the what do you call, Steve,
the random number generator?
Yeah, the random number generator. You know, they don't get picked up that well. But anyway, it is still our view from, you know, from portfolio management perspective, that the probability of Canada rolling over pretty hard at some point this year, whether now it's starting in the summer or whatever, I think it's pretty high. So then what's the central bank doing? You know, are they going to stick with the inflation data, or are they going to try, you know, to save the banks and the housing market and all that stuff with it?
Well, they but also
it might be too late though by then.
Yeah, they also noted here, they just released their, like, I guess the Bank of Canada started doing like minutes, like the Fed. So they just released their minutes yesterday. So they did make a comment about house prices and their concern about reigniting housing. So they said, while house prices continued to fall in January, recent strength in resales could translate into a pickup in house prices and stoke shelter price inflation. Which
yes.
is one of their
yes.
key reasons for not being overly excited or desperate to begin cutting rates right away.
Steve, yes. The answer is yes. They're not going to cut rates. They can't. They can't. And I know I'm sounding like a broken record, but fuck it. I'm going to do it anyways.
I feel like, go ahead.
No, no, I'm just saying the population growth is 3.2%. Rent inflation is 8 something. You've got owner accommodation is like, I think 6.7. Rental accommodation, which includes all the insurance stuff, is 7.9. Shelter is 6.5. It's rising. It's not falling. It's rising. The reason headline CPI is falling is because of a contraction in per capita demand and an allocation from normal disposable income allocated services and goods to servicing your debt. And we've talked about this. This is part of the balance sheet recession that Canada's going through because we went through a housing bubble and the unwind of that. The Bank of Canada cannot cut rates unless population growth slows. I know I'm boring. I've said it over and over again. You guys must be bored of it. I'm going to keep doing it until it gets bored. You can't do it.
Well, I think everyone agree you're anything but boring. You know, interesting, awkward. What else do you think, Steve?
I'm definitely awkward, but I'm also right.
Well,
awkwardly, I feel like right. Overconfident is another cool word.
Also quite overconfident that I'm willing to concede.
Rich,
that.
I think there's a good argument to be made though that they shouldn't be cutting rates, but they probably will anyways.
Okay, so that's a secondary conversation. I'm willing to entertain that view for sure, which is will Tiff Macklem and my heartthrob Carolyn Rogers concede to the pressures of Douglas Ford and JT and the rest of the jerks who run this country?
I'm gonna get both of you a hip check going across the blue the elbow is up as well.
Let's do it.
You know, it's like Marty McSorley hitting Doug Gilmore back in 90.
Sorry, who? Who are these people?
They're hockey players, Rich.
Like ice hockey?
From the good old days. But let's just, you know, go back. What is the Bank of Canada's mandate? What are they looking at?
Inflation. Target of 2% with a range of 1%. So from 1 to 3.
So Steve, the reason you're suggesting they will cut is because of either employment or growth. Right? That's what you say. Hey, they might have to cut. And I agree with you on that because I think growth is just going to fall out of it here. You know, as you say over here on the East Coast, the earth will fall out of it. Rich, in your side, though, I agree that inflation, you know, it can stay sticky. And one thing that you didn't bring up, and I think all of us have talked about it before as well, is that, you know, commodity prices are probably troughing here. You know, could be at the beginning of this, you know, this super commodity cycle kicking up again, you know, like the O's from like maybe 03 to 08 or into 02 or into 12 or something like that.
Before the internet.
Not 1903.
Oh, sorry.
And not 93 either, maybe. But the point is, though, we could have this situation where growth is getting very weak. So I support Steve's suggestion why they should cut. Meanwhile, they just strictly stick to their mandate of trying to control inflation. Maybe the new 2 is 2.5 or 3. You see what I mean? You can go both ways. I think we've hit the end of this, you know, 80-year Keynesian economic policy cycle. So everything central banks have relied on in the past, that's gone. That game is over. So I think even though the mandate is to look at inflation, I would lean towards what Steve is saying, is that, you know, they can see what the banks have on their balance sheets. They're chatting with them every day. You know, they see what's happening on the deficit and stuff. So you could see them reacting. I don't think they'll be proactive. I think they're going to have to react to it. But they probably have one of the worst jobs in the world. It's kind of comparable to a real estate agent during the slow months, right, Steve? During the winter and late summer? Is that what you said
earlier? Don't like these boring markets.
Yeah, you need volatility.
What do I do when the market's not going up 20% a year?
You count in your stash, right?
But it kind of brings us to, you know, the rest of the big moves this week, because it really was a big move across huge central week. Banks. Right. So you had Canada's CPI. That was kind of like the first one. I was like, oh, okay. You know, it was falling below expectations. But we had like the Fed out on Wednesday. We had the BOJ, the Bank of Japan, the Swiss National Bank. I don't even know where to start, Keith. I mean, the Fed. Why don't we start with the Fed? You watched Jay Powell's comments. I mean, they kind of seem to reiterate that they still believe that they're on path for 3 rate cuts this year. But, you know, they're data dependent and they're kind of watching it. But again, I don't know if the data, Rich, to your point, in the U.S. particularly, doesn't really support 3 cuts. But they still seem convinced that that's where they're going to be. So I'm kind of curious your thoughts.
Yeah, it's a little rich, like, you know, in that it's awkward, you know. And that's
what did I do to deserve this?
Well, you bought a $4,000 bike, you know.
It's but a nice bike. It's carbon fiber. Just saying.
Is it one of the ones where you, like you're sitting way back and?
No. It's like a beautiful handmade Italian bicycle with carbon fiber. Anyway, never mind. Go.
Okay. Cool. So one crazy thing here with the Fed right now and the. Monetary conditions have already relaxed a lot in the U.S. You know, they don't need to cut rates. So there's a lot of stuff already happening.
Can you explain that, Keith? Can you articulate how and why monetary conditions have relaxed?
Yeah, there's not a lot of slack, first of all. So first of all, you have monetary conditions. You know, a lot of it is equity markets are going higher, asset prices are going higher. You know, you have all that stuff. People feel wealthier, so they have more confidence and stuff like that. So I'll like, for example, the Michigan confidence data point that comes out. People don't realize the stock market is a pretty big contributor, you know, to that number and so forth. But so you have that happening. And at the same time, you know, the economy, there's not a lot of slack in the economy. You know, capacity utilization rates are still quite high. You know, job openings, you know, they're actually, you know, they're in an okay range as well. But the point is that we are getting this big disconnect between what the central bank should be doing. Because remember, back in December, it was going to be 150 basis points of cuts, you know, for the Americans and the Canadians and whatever. And now we're down to 75 for each one. So again, the American economy is stronger than the Canadian one. I could see this world developing where the, you know, the Yanks, you know, they don't cut rates. It doesn't happen. And then they hit that election stone wall that they're coming up to pretty soon. So if they're not cutting or they don't cut as much or the expectations of cuts are not high, and yet, you know, everyone else is cutting, you know, the dollar just surges here coming up, which is what happened on, you know, 2 days ago. So, but what were your thoughts? I thought it was more interesting what happened with Japan and the Swiss.
I kind of want to jump over your thoughts here, but there's some interesting data here from the U.S. PMI data more recently where, quote, input costs rose at the fastest pace in 6 months while firms increased their selling prices to the largest extent since April of last year. The rate of job creation ticked higher and was the fastest in 2024 so far. Staffing levels rose across both sectors with jobs growth and manufacturing hitting an 8-month high. Again, this is all quotes from the U.S. PMI data. So based on all that, you're kind of scratching your head like, really? Like 3 cuts from the Fed this year? I mean, that doesn't seem overly data dependent, but
who am I to question the wisdom of Jay Powell? I will elaborate and maybe just give people some context. When you think about U.S. data, you have to understand that there's sort of the ISM, which is like the Institute of Supply Management out of Arizona, and they sort of interview and question loads of manufacturing companies and service companies about what are they doing with CapEx, and are they hiring people, are they paying people more money, are inventories rising or falling, are prices going up or down. Services are a larger part of the economy than manufacturing, but manufacturing is a larger part of the S&P 500 than services. When you look at sort of the earnings sort of as a function of the total. When you look at the ISM composite, which is sort of a, you know, a mishmash of the two, it's above 50, which is to say it's in expansionary territory. If you're looking at new orders for services, we're above. If you look at this, so there's, and then there's regional surveys. So there's the Dallas Federal Reserve, there's the New York Federal Reserve, known as the Empire, that PMIs. There's Kansas City, there's Philly, which is a huge, there's Richmond, which is out of Richmond, Virginia. You know, so like all of these numbers are going up, and so for the U.S. Fed to insist on cutting three times when we have some impulses on the inflation side rising. Why do you know they're rising, Rich? Well, because if you look at things like Shelter X services, you'll love that. It's your favorite indicator. You hate Shelter, Steve. Well, if you X out Shelter, and on a three-month annualized basis, it's nearly 7%. And if you, even on a normal, like year-on-year number basis, it's 3.95%, which is well above the 2% number. So that's the part where I don't get it. I don't get why they're obsessed with cutting three times this year, which is what he said in their most recent comments this week. Steve, I don't really understand. I don't get why
it's kind of like they're bullied. You know, they're being bullied into
that way. Tin hat on.
And guys, make no mistake, the biggest bullies in the world, it is.
It's Nancy Pelosi, by the way. She's doing great this year.
Hey guys, it's Rich from the Looney Hour here, and I'm delighted to announce that this video is sponsored by Manscaped. Trusted for its trimmers, soaps, creams, apparel, Manscaped's been around for 10 years. The product I want to talk to you about today is the Handyman, a compact face shaver I've been testing out for months. It's equipped with a unique dual blade, featuring a standard foil shaver, as well as a blade to knock down some of your stubble on the way to giving you great shave. It features skin-safe technology designed to help reduce nicks and cuts. It's waterproof, the battery lasts for ages, and I can't recommend it enough. The bottom line is that it delivers a quick, close shave, ensuring that you look and feel your best. So please take advantage of our special deal that we've got for you today. Head over to manscaped.com and use the code LOONEYHOUR at checkout and get 20% off your purchase of the Handyman.
Let's unpack this though from a market perspective. You know, like if someone's sitting here, they got some cash on the sidelines, or they're wondering how to manage their own personal net worth here. You look at it and say, okay, you know, the Fed's coming out pretty dovish, even though the data is not that bad at all. You know, the Bank of Japan, while they might have hiked rates for the first time this year.
Oh, yeah. It's a big deal, by the way.
Well, we'll get into that. But they still came out and said, listen, we're still going to keep monetary policy very, very accommodative. Swiss National Bank was not expected to cut. They cut. The UK Central Bank, they came out very dovish. So, like, yeah, I think even the ECB was out this week. So like everybody is seemingly on this, like, hey, yeah, like gear up here. We're the boat is turning and we're going in the other direction, which is like cuts are coming. That was the overwhelming consensus from all of these central banks this week. And in the face of it, yeah, you've got, you know, stock markets ripping, crypto ripping, commodity prices re-accelerating, you know, oil prices moving higher. And so I kind of wonder, like, how does one play this? I mean, do you just go with the assumption that central banks will in fact cut rates this year into a reacceleration of prices, e.g. inflation and stronger economic growth? And so from a market perspective, you have to think things like commodities rip, and the rest of these speculative markets like crypto, it's like fuel on the fire.
I think so again, let's just reference where we were, you know, a couple of months ago, back in December, what the expectations were then, compare them to now. All these, you know, conditions that you just referenced, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if we're in the exact opposite scenario come May or June. So right now, I mean, what you just described, we have excessive optimism in financial markets. We have excessive expectations for rate cuts for every central bank on the planet. And we have an excessive expectation for a soft landing or no recession. So based on that, we have this, hey, everything is going to be awesome here. You don't need to worry. Typically in financial markets, when everyone's on, you know, we'll use the maritime analogy, when everyone's on one side of the boat, you want to get the hell over to the other side, right? Because it's gonna tip. But from a pure, you know, portfolio management perspective, and again, like, this doesn't apply to everyone, you know, you got to chat with your guy and all that, but there's everything is now priced for perfection with no risk at all. So in that environment, it doesn't mean you go all in and ride it, or you take everything out, you know, to try to protect yourself. But there are things you can do within your portfolio, you know, for protection. So an interesting today in the markets, and again, it's Thursday here. You know, yesterday after the Fed meeting, you know, the U.S. dollar fell about half a point, a half a percent maybe overall. And it was like, oh boy, like, hey, like the dollar is now going to go to zero. Equities are flying and all that stuff. And now here this morning, all the losses that the U.S. dollar had yesterday after, you know, the Fed meeting, they've all now been recovered. So the dollar is ripping higher again today. Equities are up here again today. You know, commodities are sort of, you know, moving a little bit different. But again, we're in this market right now where it is our expectation that, you know, something is going to go sort of snap, crackle, pop here in the middle of the night. And we'll make money on it. And like we'll be quite happy with that. And if it doesn't happen, then, you know, markets keep going. Again, people just have to realize how much risk is in the market. I just want to give you one anecdote, okay? Something that we look at. You've heard me before talk about private credit and the bond market, you know, and all that stuff. So this Bloomberg headline just came across my screen there earlier. It says, private credit funds dangle no-fee deals to investors.
So trying to generate liquidity, right?
Who knows, right? But they're saying, hey, give us your money. We will not charge you any fees whatsoever, you know, to manage.
Do it for free.
Doing it for free, baby.
And nothing's for free.
As I tell everyone, there's nothing free in the investment world. But again, though, the point is, you know, if you're reducing your fees significantly like that, it's because you're trying to attract money into a specific market that has no liquidity. Again, like that's a giant big yellow amber light or a flag of some sort to say, hey, you got to be a bit mindful here coming up.
So I think one of the things that Keith touched on is like the signaling. And, you know, like when people think of markets, I think people need to understand that the markets have information. There's information in the price. That's what the S&P 500 is. It's an amalgam. It's the hive mind of hundreds of thousands of Steves and Keiths all sort of compressing their view on what they think the future cash flows might be, how to discount those future cash flows, at what interest rate. And sort of imagine like a DCF, a discounted future
number
cash
go
flows
up.
of a particular of economy. And so what I do for my job and with my client talks is I look at sort of particular rotations and what we start to see, we look at things like pairs, which is like the most deeply oversold stocks or indices, which is energy. Everybody hates energy, and everybody loves tech. And so we often compare those to a ratio and see how that's moving. Or we look at, you know, there's something called the Goldman Sachs non-profitable tech, and we see how that's moving. Or we look at bellwether stocks, you know, for tech, it might be Apple or Google or Microsoft. You know, for software, it might be Oracle or Salesforce or Adobe. And we start to see what's going on. And what we've noticed over the last few months or so is we're starting to see a rotation out of like the well-loved, well-owned, you know, momentum-driven equities into unloved and, you know, deep value stocks. And usually when you have that kind of rotation where you have energy outperform tech, those are usually sort of indications of tops of market dislocations. And that's what we're sort of seeing now. And so that's why I sort of echo what sort of Keith's saying, which is, yes, you have some cyclical, you know, important factors, which is Korean exports. We talked about that last week. We have PMIs improving. But at the same time, those discounting equity markets, those equity markets that look into the future and sort of discount what's going on, are starting to rotate. And I think that that's sort of a sort of red flag. I don't know what it really means, to be honest, but I think it's worth noting and worth flagging for you guys.
Keith, do you think there's any other, you know, with all these central banks, I guess, where are the opportunities or the risks in things like, you know, currencies? You know, we talked about it, I think, last week, right? Which is like, hey, listen, the Bank of Canada probably has more air cover to begin cutting rates. But if the Fed didn't move, for example, pretty hard for the BOC to aggressively cut. And if they do start aggressively cutting, of course, your Canadian dollar gets, you know, hammered. But you're seeing all these central banks now starting to kind of move, obviously, some in slightly different directions. Is there anything that you're looking at in particular in these currency markets or in bond markets?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, you know, you just, if you're being practical about this, because I think we've concluded, hey, the American economy, hey, it's okay. It seems to be stronger than the Canadian, to give that an example. But maybe the reason why Powell and the Fed is trying to talk dovish, but in a hawkish kind of way, is because they know everyone else is starting to decline or deteriorate. Because again, if we have this global experience where everyone else is starting, like they're ahead of this, their cycle is further along than the American cycle, and that the economy rolls off and they have to cut rates and stuff like that. Meanwhile, the Americans don't have to, you know, by definition, the US dollar goes vertical in that. And that makes it even more difficult, you know, for those countries. So maybe, you know, you think about it, maybe the reason why, you know, the Fed is sort of talking about cutting rates and everything, it actually is to, you know, provide some protection, you know, to these other economies, including the Canadian one. But the biggest opportunity coming up, we do believe that the economic cycle is rolling over for a lot of economies around the world. And we think it's going to, it has the probability that's increasing that now could create this like a very strong USD strategy. So if Canadian dollar, you know, take it for what it is, you know, it could go, you know, down pretty aggressively here at this point. But the other thing that's happening here right now, again, like liquidity in the bond market is quite low. So I referenced earlier the private credit. I guess experience that's just been announced, you know, they're trying to get money in, you know, create more liquidity. If you look at Japan, for example, you know, the net issuance of Japanese government bonds, it is always being purchased by the Bank of Japan. So there's no liquidity over there either. So if we do get this moment, which will likely be in the bond market, again, there's no liquidity, you know, prices go off pretty hard. So the biggest opportunity coming up in our view, it's after the potential crisis hits, and it's then to go into the bond market. You know, then you're buying stuff on pennies on the dollar. But that's where I can see we're going, because again, we're in this world of extremes. It's at the end of the Keynesian cycle from World War II when they first set it up, and most people are asleep, Steve. You know, they just think, hey, 10 years is a long time. You know, it's always linear thinking. Again, we have probably, how much debt now, Rich, in the world? 330 trillion, maybe? 340.
I mean, it's like 300 or 400% of GDP. So,
it's right. So we're at around we're around 200 trillion, you know, before the pandemic. And, you know, the deficits are getting out of control now on the provincial side that you saw earlier.
Steve. Well, yeah, we'll get into that. But what about... do you worry that you get like a resurgence from these, you know, bond vigilantes, which is like the long end of the yield curve just kind of pushes higher once again, which is, you know, for our listeners kind of paying attention here, is basically central banks easing into inflation that begins to reaccelerate, thus pushing bond yields higher out on the curve. Which again, for people that are maybe borrowing a mortgage here in Canada, would not be good, right? So you'd see a situation potentially where the Bank of Canada is maybe cutting rates. So that might be cheaper on, let's say, your variable rate mortgage product, but your 5-year fix, meanwhile, is going from 5% to 6% to 6.5% to 7%. And so those costs kind of blow out.
Yeah, so we've a couple of months ago, we put in protections, you know, protect us against long-term rates going higher, because that's definitely a risk. You know, the whole, like, the bond vigilante, you know, story and narrative, I expect that central banks will always be incredibly aggressive and proactive in protecting their own sovereign debt bond market. So it's the corporate bond world. So anything that's touching, you know, credit spreads, including preferred shares, you know, these things can go down pretty aggressively. I think that's what's open. And then the FX side. So,
I mean, the fancy way of saying what Keith is articulating is financial repression. And, you know, it's an economic term that refers to when governments indirectly borrow from industry to pay off public debt. And there's different ways to do this. Keith and I disagree on how this might happen, but we agree sort of on the end goal, which is financial repression, which is, you know, if you keep inflation much, much higher, or you allow it to be much higher than the borrowing costs, you in effect, it's another way of so-called financial repression. If you force pension funds to buy local currency equity markets, that's financial repression. And so to me, that's I think what we're working.
Yeah, there was an article actually out today highlighting the Bank of Canada, who's currently engaging quantitative tightening, right? Like shrinking their balance sheet after buying up rich, 40% of all Canada.
No. It was at one point, it was 97 or 95% of all issuance during COVID.
All new issuance. Nuts. And then at one point, they basically owned 40% of the entire market.
That's right.
And so they've obviously, through this tightening process, they begin sort of unwinding that excess. But there's an article out here today from Bloomberg saying Bank of Canada sees quantitative tightening ending in 2025, and then will consider primary and secondary purchases when the program ends. So basically, effectively saying they're going to get back into the pool most likely in 2025. And I think that's a pretty big potential story here.
That's like, you ever watch a movie, not a movie, a TV show, and they give you scenes from next week? You know, you used to have that when I was a kid. you know, you're watching Gilligan's Island or something, and scenes from next week. I think that maybe that's what they're doing. And I think it'll happen, you know, before that 25 days when the balance sheet gets run down quite a bit.
They're trying to say that we'll start buying Government of Canada bonds and other assets again as part of our normal balance sheet management, but those purchases will not be considered quantitative easing. But like, Rich,
what would it be then? What would it be considered, Rich?
Yield buying in the primary market.
It's yield curve. All that's bullshit. What it is they're trying to manage the yield curve. They want, so what does that mean to people? So yield curve is the interest rate that you pay for a specific time, a specific bond, either 1 month or 2 month or 3 month or 5 month or 8 month or a year, 10 years or whatever. And what they want to do is they want to manage. And the reason I use my arms to sort of describe it is they don't want yields at the back end, so further out the curve, which is a longer term, to go up if they think that Justin Trudeau's budget is bananas, or they don't want the near-term interest rates to skyrocket if people don't believe the monetary policy statements or whatever. So what they're doing by issuing debt or buying debt or whatever it is they do, they're yield curve control. They're managing that bond yield across different maturities. That's not unheard of. They did it after World War II, I would argue with good reason. They will do it in the future. They're doing it now. Who knows what's going on? My point is, to me, all this is riffraff. It's all theater. They are controlling the interest rate, and it's all basically a form of financial oppression. Keith, do you disagree with that?
Yeah, they're acting like commies, really. I mean, they're trying to...
Come on!
Well, they are. They're trying to suppress the global yield curve. And the reason they do that, because if rates go higher anywhere on the yield curve, again, it's game over. Because we've hit this maximum amount of debt that's been accumulated off the ground floor, like zero or a half a point and everything. So they know that if rates go higher, if it's the 1 year, 5 year, 30 year, 10 year, everything just breaks with it. So right. Yeah, they have to do this. But again, this is our view in that as long or as soon as you recognize why this is happening and the reason it's happening, because it is the end of this, you know, super, you know, debt cycle or bond bubble, whatever you want to call it, you know, you try to prolong it or stall it. And what they're stalling is price discovery.
Right.
So it's like Steve, like in your world, you know, what's price discovery? It's when the buyer and seller agree on a price, right? And if there's no one to buy anything, you know, there's no bid, you know, what's the true value of it? And again, there's no liquidity there.
But so Keith, can I jump in there? I think that's what people don't understand, I think, in general. When we talk about yields is just another way of saying price. And so we often talk about yields, 3% bond yield, 5% bond yield, 10% bond yield. What that is effectively a price. And when the yield goes up, the bond price goes down. I know it's maybe some of us might think that that's a very simplistic term, but I think a lot of people don't get it. And so when you have a bond, for example, the Argentinian bonds right now are trading at 40 cents on the dollar. And the yield is 15%, right? Because, you know, the president in his infinite wisdom is cutting whatever it is. And so as the yields come down, those prices will go up. And so if no one is willing to purchase that bond, which is what Keith is alluding to, which is to say there's no one to step in and buy that asset, whether it's a house or a car or a bond or whatever it is, those yields spike. And I think that's really what we're dealing with. And so central banks get involved to artificially massage effectively that price. Steve, sorry.
I mean, that's a, you know, we've talked about financial repression since I think the day we started this podcast, which is, you know, I don't know if there was really such a thing as free markets, but you know, speaking on that, there was an article out this week, originally from Better Dwelling, but highlighting that the government of Canada has begun buying billions of dollars in Canada mortgage bonds, and so there was, you know, we had quite a few listeners asking us what this all means, what are the implications of it. So Canada's is going to be spending 75% of its planned budget deficit to buy mortgage bonds. Now, what does this really mean? Basically, they're forecasted $40 billion this year. So 75% of that cash they're going to be borrowing will be used to provide cheaper mortgages. So basically, what it means is, in Canada, you have when the banks write and issue a mortgage, these mortgages then get bundled up into mortgage-backed securities, and then basically into a mortgage bond, which basically gets sold to an investor and kind of like de-risks a lot of those mortgages off of the bank's balance sheet. And obviously, when you have a larger ability to sell more of those mortgage bonds, it frees up more lending capacity for the bank. And so it's quite unusual. It's a little bit complicated, but it's very unusual to see these mortgages are already insured by CMHC, which is our own government entity. And now the Canadian government, the federal government, is coming in and buying the own bonds that they're already insuring. So it's distorting a price signal in the market. So originally,
they're all commies, Steve.
Yeah, it's really on. Well, originally, basically what was supposed to happen is they were actually supposed to remove the Canada Mortgage Bond Program. The federal government said, we're going to get rid of this. And then they actually increased the issuance, I think from $40 billion to $60 billion. And then they said, in addition to that, we're actually going to start buying our own issuance effectively.
So wait, before you get into it, the idea that banks issue mortgages and then securitize them and sell them to other people is not in and of itself a bad thing, right? So there's some people who have assets.
You
and liabilities.
Do, they do that in the U.S. as well.
What I'm saying is, it's not a bad thing, right? This idea that it's a bad thing is
yeah, but bullshit. Selling them to a pension fund is
no, wait. Okay, what I'm saying to you, if you can, the whole point is matching your, if your mortgage is over 30 years and you have a, that's a liability and your assets and you match your assets and liability, that's fine. Your point, Steve, is that the government is coming in and artificially inflating a market that shouldn't exist, or the market should be 20% down and it's propping up the market, right? Is that your
view? Yeah, I mean, it's, and effectively what it's doing is it's basically, it's actually, I think this is why the government has done it. Is it's effectively lowering
the cost of capital.
Well, it's lowering the interest rates on these mortgages, particularly for insured mortgages, right? This is what these bonds are. The insured mortgages are typically borrowers that are borrowing less than 20% down. They have to go through CMHC because CMHC is the insurer of those mortgages. And so the banks look at it and say, wow, well, there's not really a whole lot of risk for us. Right? We give you a mortgage, you put down 10%, we lend you the other 90%, but CMHC is guaranteeing that loan. So when you default, it's not really our problem. It's CMHC's problem. So effectively in Canada, that's the reason why if you're a borrower, Rich, and you put 5% down, you are going to get a better interest rate on your mortgage than me when I put down 30% on my mortgage. Which is kind of ass backwards, right? Like that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's because, again, the Canadian government through CMHC is taking on all the risk.
How dare you question the wisdom of inflating our housing market in perpetuity, Keith?
Yeah. So I don't know if the grand, like there's another article here in the Hub where there's a lot of people kind of scratching their heads on this program.
It's bullshit.
In terms of the government basically actually buying up their own debt. It is that part is quite unusual.
But no one votes for people when their houses are, I'm sure Keith wants to jump in here, but no one votes for you when your house is down, house prices are down.
So a couple of things here. So first of all, you know, I like how it's phrased. So the CMHC will take on the debt, or the government will take on the debt. We are taking on the debt.
Who's the largest shareholder of the CMHC, Keith?
It's you.
Thank you.
Taxpayers. Yeah, absolutely. Like that famous quote from the Prime Minister back. Well, one of his infamous quotes when COVID was going on. You know, we took on the debt so you wouldn't have to.
That's bullshit. We're the taxpayers.
We all took on the debt. So, you know, again, it's happening here. So a couple of points here. First of all, this is similar to the private credit fund headline that I shared earlier. You know, they're trying to get liquidity into the market. You know, same thing with this, because then it, you know, encourages the banks to lend and that stuff. But the interesting thing with this, you know, that should, you know, everyone like it should go boom, you know, above their head to go, oh, wow. Yeah. Loony guys are smart. This is now quantitative easing taking place by the Treasury or the Minister of Finance instead of the central bank. So instead of the Bank of Canada doing QT, or quantitative tightening, now, in the way I heard you, Steve, from the article, is that it's the, you know, it's the Canadian Treasury Department, which is using, you know, funds from what they're borrowing to buy these mortgage-backed securities. So they're actually, you know, doing QE like from the fiscal side, which is a whole nother story. Think about this: when just say you do quantitative easing, the central bank has these securities on their balance sheet. And they have losses on it, which has happened for the ECB and everything. And the Fed had this stuff as well. And they came with the rule that, you know, they're not losses. They're just negative gains. You know, it's an accounting issue. See, I can be geeky and funny as well, Rich. But now all of a sudden, if the Canadian government is taking, you know, again, they borrowed money. Say they borrowed, you know, of that $40 billion deficit, they take $30 billion. It's in cash they borrowed. And instead of putting that into healthcare, because God knows we need improved healthcare, or education, we need better education as well, or housing, or whatever else you want to think of, you know, now all of a sudden they're going to go buy a financial asset, hoping to have a secondary or thirdary effect to bring the cost of housing down, which will help
their tertiary.
So what we've seen.
Wait, one more thing. There's one more step.
Get in there.
more step. Now this asset, which is now like mortgage-backed securities, right? They're now sitting on the balance sheet of the federal government. So let's just say we do go into a deep recession. Say that happens. Say the banks all of a sudden say, screw this, we're not lending anymore at all. We need, you know, some visibility coming up here. These mortgage-backed securities, you know, you go back to like the Big Short, you know, book and movie and whatever, you know, they can't get anyone to buy.
It's a bubble.
It's a bubble. Yeah. All of a sudden, the Canadian government is sitting on like a giant pile of stinky, steaming
turd.
The three babbling turds have identified another big pile of turd that could potentially be there. But Steve, that doesn't matter because it's the government taking it on.
Yeah. I mean, apparently.
This is crazy, guys. This is like loony.
So anyways, long story short, the recent estimates are showing that it's dropped insured mortgage rates by about 15 to 20 basis points. So I suppose if you're a first time home buyer putting down 10% and leveraging yourself up, you can thank JT for the 20 basis.
This is what we need. What we need in Canada is to allocate more money from asset holders. Sorry, from wage earners to asset holders. That's what we need to do. We need to allocate. If you're a hardworking laborer, we need to tax you and then shift that money over to non-working asset hold. I mean, it's bananas. It's totally bananas to do that. I know I'm making like a philosophical argument against that, but that's what it is. You have laborers who are taxed on their wages and their income, and by subsidizing interest rates, e.g. lowering the cost of capital, you are effectively it's a wealth transfer from laborers to asset holders, and it's bullshit. And I never ever.
So let's just say $30 billion of this, you know, it goes towards, you know, mortgage-backed securities that's packaged with, you know, the 10% down. Okay. And, you know, that 10% gets vaporized overnight for whatever reason. You know, the economy has a recession. I know commies don't like to
impossible.
Hear that, but it does happen. So now all of a sudden, you know, now you have the federal government on their balance sheet just sitting on $30 billion of a turd. You know, this, you know, to be dramatic here, it's now marked as zero. They ring up the CMHC, which is across the hallway or something from them, or on the next floor up or down, and say, hey, you need to, we're collecting insurance on this. To which they reply, okay, one second. They ring up the Minister of Finance and say, hey, we need some more money here because we got to pay you guys for the insurance collection that you're going on. And they say, okay, one second, we need to borrow some more money, you know, to cover this. And as they go to borrow, all of a sudden there's no market to borrow because it's now become a shit show in Canada. They call the Bank of Canada and they say, hey, we need you to buy this new bond issuance we're doing so we can give it to the CMHC. The CMHC then give it to the Minister of Finance so then we can recover the insurance losses from the mortgage-backed security with a 10% down. And then they announce everything is whole.
Keith, I figured it out. If we tax carbon, we can kill all the birds with one stone.
Oh, boy. I wasn't expecting this conversation.
Man, this took a turn.
So, but it goes back to earlier. You're asking, hey, you know, Keith, like, what do you see could go wrong here? Like, is this an awesome environment we're in? And now you just heard it. It doesn't mean this has to happen, but this is the way, when you're managing money, you got to think about these events. And is this a 1% probability or 10 or 30? I don't know. All I know right now, everything here is wrecking us. So guys, real quick, 30 seconds on the Bank of Japan. You know what the big news was?
Yeah, you have to say it. Go for it.
Nothing. They raised rates from minus 0.1 to zero.
It was the first time in 17 years. That's a big deal.
But nothing else has changed. You know, it's really, they're still buying 100% of debt issuance by the Japanese government. They still own, I'm going to make up the number, but I'm close to it, Rich. I think they own about 85%
it's very
of
high.
Equity ETF issuance as
well.
Oh,
it's ridiculous.
So nothing is changing. Of course, when you see, and you know, they have to protect the bond market. So by default, you know, the currency gets mullered. And then by default of that, you know, equities go up, you know, in Japan. So you have that happening. So that's, again, this is the crazy world we're in. You have
I have something to say about the Bank of Japan. The show Shogun is amazing. That is all.
Is that an old movie?
No, it's a new show on I think it's Amazon Prime or Netflix or Disney Plus, whatever it is. It's Shogun. It's a show about, it's a rehash of James Carvel's novel about this English guy who goes to Japan in the 1800s and
has sex. So when I was growing up with the TV movie of the week, it was
Black and White.
I think it was Richard Chamberlain starring in that.
It's a great show, and I highly recommend it. Two thumbs up.
It was a made-for-TV movie. They had scenes from next week, Steve. That was always the fun thing to see.
That was the best. Rich, you did bring up the carbon tax, so we'll end it on that. But I do wonder, that's supposed to go up 24%, 26% April 1st?
23%, I think.
23. I do wonder, is that going to make the BOC's job a little bit more difficult?
Yes, of course. Taxes are inflationary. I don't care what JT and his cabal of people who are not cogent.
Jeff will cut
thinking.
That one out, buddy.
Anyways, and his cabal of people who don't do math or know how to use the internet think taxes are always inflationary. Full stop. Anything they tell you is bogus. I will say thank you to all the people who write to us. I think we get at least 3 or 4 emails a week, some encouraging, some less encouraging. We try our best to answer them all. Steve gets on our case because we don't answer them fast enough. Keith never answers any of them. So that's we're just showing you how the sausage is made here at the Looney Hour. But
big firewall. Can't get through that guy.
We've gotten a lot of questions about the carbon tax. And listen, it's not that we don't think that we should lower emissions. It's that we think that there's ways to virtue signal about lowering emissions and there's ways to do it effectively. And I would just submit to you, as we submitted to the author of the most recent email, that the way that United States have cut their emissions by almost 30% was through natural gas. So, Steve, I know I wasn't allowed to do a rant this week, but sorry, I snuck it in.
Well, we'll have more to discuss April 1st. But as always, guys, we appreciate your support. Thanks for tuning in. And we hope that you buy a Manscaped razor. Support the Looney Hour. And we'll see you next week.